A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Cast, which I think is very appropriate, given that it's something that I've thought a lot about, certainly over the past few years. And I think that it's one of those things where AI really shines. It's irregularities in sensory processing. It's often something that has been buried in developmental literature and really kind of hidden away from people who are actually trying to just make sense of their own sensory experience. And that, I think, is a great beauty of AI. It takes information that's just been sitting there, you know, on digital shelves as opposed to physical shelves. But if no one's reading that stuff, it's away just in another way. We talk about how the internet made, you know, it's like having a library at your fingertips, but it's created so much information that there's an equal problem that has emerged of it's just not surfaced. And AI excels in surfacing all this information, I think. Something about the sensory stuff that has really connected with me, I don't know to what extent it's scientific, is that we each have kind of our sensory capacity or load. It's that kind of jaded metaphor of a glass of water being, you know, if we have sensory sensitivity, it might be half full to begin with, as opposed to someone else. But today was a day where we had young Ezra, who was he's been kind of in a screaming phase for the past few days. Maybe due to his new teeth coming in. And for other reasons, it just felt like the sensory inputs were accumulating past our capacity to deal with them. And on those days, I was thinking today about the concept of sensory deprivation, how these kind of tanks that were really in vogue a few years ago, where people would like put literally dunk themselves in water just to get away from the sensory world. And I have to say, when I saw those videos in the news and read about them, I actually thought, well, that's actually a really smart idea, but I don't like it because it kind of suggests that in order to decrease our sensory exposure in a way that might be really helpful, we need to go to a obscure facility and pay someone a lot of money to sit in their sensory deprivation tank. It's kind of a ridiculous parody, actually, of... And it's disempowering because I think that all the ways, I suspect that if anyone wanted to create their own at-home sensory escape room, you could probably do it for like the cost of a session in a sensory deprivation tank, buy up some blackout curtains, a good eye mask, some earplugs, and you're basically set. So I'd love to talk today about that idea, the less radical version of the sensory deprivation tank, the kind of sensory reduction. And that's another issue that I have with sensory deprivation, or maybe that we should talk about, because it seems to me people might have had that experience where you're in a place, a room that is artificially quiet. Maybe it's a recording studio or something. And it's actually very eerie. There is a basic level of sensory input that humans actually need to stay sane. So when we're talking about obliterating sensory inputs, if we're feeling overwhelmed by it, I feel like that framing is just implicitly wrong to begin with. It's not something that most people need or would find helpful. It's just about turning it down. Here's my own sensory deprivation recipe. Sometimes I like to listen to the Herman and Corn podcast, or now called My Word Prompts. And I'll just go into a quiet room, close the curtains, and just kind of listen and sort of tune out the world except for what Herman and Corn are saying. I don't do this very often, but the few times that I do are just literally sometimes even without a podcast, just sit there. It can be really nice. Something I like as well in the very warm climate we have here in Israel is to run the air conditioner. Or lie on the ground. I'm a big fan of just lying flat out on the ground of the kitchen and feeling the cool floor beneath me. And that's another thing that really grounds me and kind of just really I find very relaxing. And I think it all comes back to sensory stuff. It's if we ask what's the point of sitting in air conditioning or lying on the ground, it's because It's just to feel cool when the surrounding temperature is hot. So Herman and Korn, we've talked about sensory processing disorder, SPD. We've talked about that great book. I'm going to botch the name. Too Hot, Too Cold. No, that's definitely not the name. This is a good book about sensory processing, but rather than frame it in purely in terms of disorders, let's look at some practical things that people could do if they're feeling that the sensory world is just coming at them a bit too intensively and they want to create their own little respite from that without having to sign up for a subscription to somebody's sensory deprivation tank.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's personal in the best way. He's been thinking about sensory overload, not as a clinical diagnosis, but as something that just happens when you're a parent, when the world is loud, when your toddler's been screaming for 3 days because teeth are coming in. And he landed on this tension I think is really worth digging into. On one side, you've got the sensory deprivation tank, this kind of high-tech, expensive, almost clinical approach to escaping sensation. On the other, the much simpler question of what you can actually do at home, with blackout curtains and a cool floor, to just turn the volume down. And he's pushing back on the whole deprivation framing. He's saying most people don't need sensory obliteration. They need sensory reduction. That distinction feels important.
It is important, and I think it gets at something the whole commercial wellness industry has kind of muddied. The sensory deprivation tank, or more accurately, the flotation tank, was invented by John Lilly back in the 1950s. He was a neuroscientist, and his original interest was in testing what happens to the brain when you strip away all external input. It was a research tool. Then it became a therapeutic thing, then a new age thing, and now it's a boutique spa service where you pay $80 for an hour in a pod full of Epsom salts. The journey from neuroscience experiment to luxury wellness product is, honestly, kind of a parable.
Daniel's point is that there's something almost disempowering about that. Like, the message becomes, if you're overwhelmed by the sensory world, you need to go to a special facility and pay a specialist to solve it for you. When actually, the core insight, reducing sensory input, is something you can do with $40 worth of blackout curtains and a decent pair of earplugs.
And I want to be fair to flotation tanks, because there is legitimate research on them. A meta-analysis published in 2014 looked at 27 studies and found that flotation rest, which stands for Restricted Environmental Stimulation Therapy, has measurable effects on reducing cortisol, lowering blood pressure, and decreasing subjective stress. It's not snake oil. But the question Daniel's asking is whether the benefit is really about the tank, or whether it's about the principle. And I think the evidence points toward the principle. The active ingredient is the reduction of sensory input, not the specific technology of the saltwater pod.
Let's get into the framework Daniel's actually proposing. He talks about sensory capacity as a kind of glass. Some people start the day with their glass already half full. And then a screaming toddler, a hot day, the hum of an air conditioner that's slightly too loud, all of these things just keep adding until it overflows. And the overflow is what we experience as overwhelm, irritability, the feeling of just wanting to crawl out of your own skin.
That glass metaphor, it's not exactly scientific, but it actually maps pretty well onto what the research says about sensory gating. Sensory gating is the brain's ability to filter out irrelevant stimuli. It's a neurological process, not a psychological one. Your brain is constantly deciding what to let through to conscious awareness and what to suppress. For some people, that filter is just leakier. It lets more through. And that's not a failure of willpower or a character flaw. It's literally a difference in how the thalamus and the prefrontal cortex are managing sensory traffic.
This is where Daniel mentioned that book he couldn't quite name. I think he was reaching for Too Loud, Too Bright, Too Fast, Too Tight.
By Sharon Heller. Published in 2002. It's a book about sensory defensiveness, a subtype of sensory processing sensitivity where people have aversive reactions to sensations that others would find neutral or even pleasant. The tag on the back of your shirt. The hum of a fluorescent light. For someone with sensory defensiveness, these aren't minor annoyances, they're genuinely distressing. And the book was one of the first to take this out of the clinical literature and say, look, this is something a lot of people experience, and there are practical things you can do about it.
I think that's what Daniel's really after here. Not just the theory, but the practical things. He goes into a quiet room. He closes the curtains. He lies on the kitchen floor because the tiles are cool. He runs the air conditioner. He listens to a podcast, sometimes ours, which I'll take as a compliment, even though I suspect it's mostly about having a familiar voice to focus on while everything else fades out.
It is a compliment, and it's also a technique. Focusing on a single controlled auditory input can actually help the sensory gating system recalibrate. It's giving your brain one thing to attend to, which paradoxically makes it easier to suppress everything else. There's a reason white noise machines work for sleep. It's not that the white noise is inherently soothing. It's that it provides a constant, predictable auditory floor that makes sudden noises less disruptive. Your brain stops scanning for threats because the baseline is stable.
Let's talk about the home sensory reduction kit Daniel's proposing. He mentioned blackout curtains, an eye mask, earplugs. What else would you put on that list?
Weighted blankets have pretty solid research behind them. The deep pressure stimulation activates the parasympathetic nervous system, the branch that calms you down. It's the same principle as swaddling a baby or the thunder shirts people use for anxious dogs. The pressure sends a signal of safety to the nervous system. A study in the Journal of Clinical Sleep Medicine in 2020 found that weighted blankets significantly improved sleep for people with insomnia, and the effect was even stronger for those with ADHD or anxiety disorders.
I've seen those blankets. They look like something you'd use to smother a small fire.
They're heavy, yes, typically around 10-15% of your body weight. But the sensation for a lot of people is like being held. It's grounding. And grounding has a specific meaning in sensory integration therapy. Grounding techniques are ways of anchoring your attention in the present moment through physical sensation. Daniel lying on the cool kitchen floor, that's grounding. The cold tiles against his skin are a strong, unambiguous sensory signal that pulls his attention out of the overwhelm and into the immediate physical environment.
It's interesting that he gravitates toward temperature specifically. The air conditioning, the cool floor. Is there something about thermal sensation that makes it particularly effective for this?
There is, actually. Thermal receptors in the skin have a pretty direct pathway to the insula, a brain region involved in interoception, the perception of your own internal bodily states. When you're overheated, your body is in a state of mild physiological stress. Your heart rate is up, your sympathetic nervous system is activated. Cooling the skin sends an immediate signal that reverses some of that. It's not just psychologically pleasant, it's physiologically calming. A cool floor on a hot day is a much gentler way of getting that same autonomic shift than, say, cold water immersion.
We've got thermoregulation, deep pressure, auditory control, visual reduction. Daniel's basically assembling a toolkit for modulating each sensory channel independently. And I think that's a much more useful way to think about this than the deprivation model. It's not about turning everything off. It's about having a dimmer switch for each sense.
This is actually what occupational therapists call a sensory diet. It's a personalized set of sensory activities designed to keep your nervous system in an optimal state of arousal. Some people need more stimulation in certain channels and less in others. Someone might need a lot of proprioceptive input, the sense of where your body is in space, through heavy lifting or climbing, but very little auditory input. Someone else might crave vestibular input, spinning, swinging, but be overwhelmed by bright light. The point is that it's individualized, and you can figure out your own sensory diet through experimentation without ever stepping into a clinic.
I want to push on something Daniel said about the eeriness of artificially quiet spaces. He mentioned recording studios, and I've had that experience too. You walk into a room that's been acoustically treated to be completely dead, and it's unsettling. Your own voice sounds weird. You can hear your heartbeat. It's not relaxing. It's almost agitating in a different way.
That's a real phenomenon, and it actually supports Daniel's argument against the deprivation model. Humans are not designed for sensory zero. Our auditory system evolved in environments that always had some ambient sound. Wind, water, birds, insects. Complete silence is anomalous, and the brain treats anomalies as potential threats. If you're in a truly silent room, your auditory system actually ramps up its gain, trying to detect any signal. You start hearing your own blood flow, your own breathing. For some people, that's deeply uncomfortable. It can even trigger anxiety or panic.
The goal isn't silence, it's the right kind of noise.
And the right kind of noise varies by person. Some people do well with white noise. Others prefer pink noise, which has more low-frequency energy and sounds more like rainfall or ocean waves. Brown noise is even deeper, more like a waterfall or distant thunder. These are acoustic profiles with different spectral distributions, and different brains respond to them differently. The key is that they all provide a consistent, predictable auditory background that reduces the startle response to sudden sounds.
Daniel also mentioned something I think is worth pulling out, which is that he sometimes just sits in a quiet room with no podcast, no input at all, and that can be really nice. And I think there's a distinction between sensory reduction and sensory control. When you're listening to a podcast, you're still getting auditory input, but you're choosing it. You're in control of it. The overwhelm comes when you're not in control, when the inputs are imposed on you.
That's a really important insight. When you feel like you can't escape the noise, the heat, the chaos, your stress response escalates. But when you know you have an exit, when you know there's a quiet room you can retreat to, the same inputs become more tolerable. It's not just the sensory load itself, it's the perceived control over it. A study from 2018 in the Journal of Environmental Psychology found that perceived control over noise was a better predictor of annoyance and stress than the actual decibel level. People who felt they could make the noise stop if they wanted to reported lower stress, even if they never actually exercised that option.
Which means that just knowing you have a sensory escape room in your home is itself a kind of stress reducer, even on days when you don't use it.
That's the most powerful argument for setting up something like what Daniel's describing. It's not that you'll spend hours a day in your darkened, cool, quiet room. It's that knowing it's there changes your relationship to the sensory chaos of the rest of the house. You're not trapped in it. You have a refuge.
Let's talk about the practical setup then. Daniel threw out a cost estimate. He said you could probably do this for the cost of a single session in a sensory deprivation tank. What's the actual math on that?
A flotation session typically runs between $60 and $100 for an hour. So let's say $80 as a midpoint. Blackout curtains for a single room, maybe $30 to $50. A decent sleep mask, $15 to $20. A good pair of reusable silicone earplugs, maybe $15. And if you want to add a weighted blanket, those can range from $40 for a basic one to over $100 for a premium one. So the full setup could run anywhere from $60 on the low end to maybe $200 if you go for the weighted blanket and nicer curtains. But the point is, it's a one-time cost, and you can use it every day for years.
You're not floating in salt water in a pod, which, I don't know about you, but there's something about the claustrophobia of those tanks that I find deeply unappealing.
Claustrophobia is actually one of the most common reasons people don't complete flotation sessions. Some facilities have open pools instead of enclosed pods, but even then, you're in water that's exactly body temperature, so you lose the sense of where your skin ends and the water begins. That can be transcendent for some people and terrifying for others. The home approach is more modular. You can adjust each element independently. If the eye mask feels too restrictive, you can take it off and just use the blackout curtains. If complete silence is eerie, you can add in some ambient sound. You're not locked into a single configuration.
I want to circle back to something Daniel said about AI, because I think it connects to this in a way that's not immediately obvious. He talked about how AI excels at surfacing information that's been sitting on digital shelves, unread, and that the whole field of sensory processing has been kind of buried in developmental literature, inaccessible to people who are just trying to understand their own experience. And I think that's true, but I also think there's a flip side.
What's the flip side?
The flip side is that AI can also surface a lot of nonsense. If you ask a large language model about sensory processing, it's going to give you a mix of legitimate clinical information and wellness influencer pseudoscience, and it might not be great at distinguishing between the two. So there's still a curation problem. Daniel seems to have done the work of finding the good stuff, the book by Sharon Heller, the actual research. But I wonder how many people are getting their sensory advice from an AI summary that's blending occupational therapy with something someone made up for TikTok.
That's a fair concern, and it's one of the reasons I think understanding the underlying mechanisms matters more than following any specific protocol. If you understand that sensory gating is a neurological process, that your nervous system has an optimal arousal range, and that you can modulate different sensory channels independently, then you can evaluate any piece of advice against that framework. If someone tells you that crystals will realign your sensory chakras, you can probably set that aside. If someone tells you that weighted blankets provide deep pressure stimulation that activates the parasympathetic nervous system, that's testable and supported.
The chakra realignment industry is going to come for you, Herman.
I've got citations.
Let's get concrete. If someone is listening to this and thinking, yeah, I've had days where I feel like my skin is crawling and every sound is a needle, what's the first thing they should do?
The first thing is to identify which sensory channels are the problem, and that's not always obvious. Someone might think they're irritated by noise, but actually the primary overload is visual, and the auditory sensitivity is just a downstream effect of an already overwhelmed system. So you do a quick audit. When you feel overwhelmed, what are the conditions? Is the room too bright? Is there a flickering fluorescent light? Are there multiple competing sounds? Is your clothing uncomfortable? Is the temperature off? And then you address the most intense input first. Often, fixing one channel has a cascading effect. If you put on sunglasses or dim the lights, suddenly the noise becomes more tolerable. Your sensory systems aren't independent. They share processing resources.
You're saying the sensory budget, or the glass of water Daniel was talking about, it's not like there's a separate glass for each sense. It's one glass, and everything pours into it.
That's actually a pretty good way to put it. The term in the literature is multisensory integration. Your brain is constantly combining inputs from different senses into a unified experience of the world, but that integration takes energy. When one channel is demanding a lot of processing power, there's less available for the others. It's like running too many applications on a computer. The fan gets loud, everything slows down, and eventually the system crashes. Reducing the load on any one application frees up resources for everything else.
If you're in a hot room with a screaming toddler and a flickering light, you might not be able to stop the toddler from screaming, but you can turn off the light and turn up the air conditioner, and suddenly the screaming is more manageable.
That's empowering, because you often can't control the biggest source of sensory input. You can't control traffic noise or construction next door. You can't always control a teething child. But you can control your environment in smaller ways that shift the total load enough to keep you under threshold.
Daniel mentioned the screaming phase. Ezra's been at it for a few days, probably teeth coming in. And I think there's something specific about infant and toddler vocalizations that makes them especially hard to filter out.
A baby's cry is evolutionarily designed to be impossible to ignore. The acoustic profile of infant crying, especially the frequency range between about 2 and 4 kHz, is precisely where human hearing is most sensitive. And it triggers an immediate autonomic response. Heart rate goes up. Your brain treats it as an emergency signal. It doesn't matter that you know, rationally, that the baby is fine, just uncomfortable from teething. Your nervous system responds before your prefrontal cortex can intervene. And if you're already sensory sensitive, that response is going to be even more intense.
You've got this sound that's biologically engineered to pierce through every filter you have, and it's happening in your own home, and you can't escape it, and it's been going on for 3 days. That's not a failure of coping skills. That's a extreme sensory environment.
This is why the concept of a sensory refuge is not a luxury. It's not self-indulgent. It's a practical necessity for anyone in a high sensory load environment, which includes basically every parent of a young child. Daniel's approach, lying on the cool kitchen floor, running the air conditioner, putting on a podcast, that's not avoidance. It's strategic sensory management. He's not abandoning his responsibilities. He's taking a 10-minute reset so he can go back and be a better parent.
I think that reframe is important, because there's a guilt that comes with needing to step away, especially for parents. The message from the culture is that you should be able to handle it, that if you're overwhelmed, you're somehow failing. But that's just not how nervous systems work. Some people have leakier sensory gates. Some environments are more intense. When you combine those two things, you're going to hit your limit. Having a plan for what to do when you hit your limit isn't weakness, it's competence.
It's modeling good self-regulation for your kids. Ezra's too young to understand it now, but as he grows up, he's going to see that when things feel overwhelming, there are things you can do. You can find a quiet space. You can cool down. You can put on headphones. Those are skills he'll internalize.
Let's talk about the other end of the sensory spectrum for a moment, because I think it helps clarify what we're talking about. There are people who are sensory seekers. They crave intense input. They like loud music, bright lights, strong flavors, roller coasters. And they might look at Daniel's quiet, dark room and think it sounds like punishment.
And that's why the sensory diet concept is individualized. A sensory seeker's optimal environment might be a crowded concert or a high-intensity workout. But here's the thing. Even sensory seekers can hit overload just at a higher threshold. And when they do, the same principles apply. Reduce the input. Give the nervous system a break. The difference is just where the threshold is. The underlying mechanism is the same.
I think the prevalence of sensory sensitivity is probably higher than most people realize. The research on highly sensitive persons, or HSPs, a term coined by Elaine Aron in the 1990s, suggests that about 15-20% of the population has a temperament characterized by deeper processing of sensory information. That's not a disorder. It's a normal variation. But it means that for a significant chunk of people, the modern sensory environment is challenging.
Aron's work has been replicated fairly extensively. The highly sensitive person scale has been validated in multiple cultures and languages, and the core finding is that sensitivity is a trait, not a pathology. Highly sensitive people tend to be more creative, more empathic, more attuned to subtleties that others miss, but they also get overwhelmed more easily. The same neurological receptivity that makes them good at noticing things also makes them vulnerable to overstimulation.
Which, if you think about it, is a pretty good argument for designing environments that are more sensory-friendly by default. Not just for people with clinical sensory processing disorder, but for the 15-20% of people who are just wired to be more sensitive. And honestly, even for the other 80% who benefits from a world that's louder and brighter and more chaotic.
There's a whole field called sensory design that's starting to get traction in architecture and urban planning. The idea is that you can create spaces that are stimulating without being overwhelming, natural light instead of harsh fluorescence. Materials that absorb sound instead of reflecting it. Access to green space. These aren't extravagant luxuries, they're basic features of environments that support human functioning. And the research shows that these design choices have measurable effects on stress, productivity, and even physical health.
The home sensory escape room Daniel's describing is kind of a micro version of sensory design. He's taking a small space and optimizing it for his own nervous system. And he's doing it on a budget, with stuff you can buy on Amazon or at a hardware store.
I think the most important thing he's doing is giving himself permission to use it. That's the step a lot of people miss. They might have blackout curtains in their bedroom, but they never close them during the day because they feel like they should be up and doing things. They might have earplugs in a drawer somewhere, but they don't put them in because it feels like admitting defeat. There's a cultural bias against sensory self-care that we need to get over.
I think part of that bias comes from the deprivation tank framing. If sensory relief is something you have to pay $80 an hour for at a specialized facility, then doing it at home feels like a cheap imitation or like you're not taking it seriously enough. But if you reframe it as sensory modulation, as just adjusting the environment to meet your needs, then it's no different from putting on a sweater when you're cold or turning on a light when it's dark. It's just another way of regulating your experience.
The research supports the idea that small, frequent sensory breaks are more effective than occasional extreme interventions. A 2022 study in the Journal of Occupational Health Psychology looked at micro breaks during the workday and found that even 5 minutes of sensory reduction, stepping away from screens, finding a quiet corner, closing your eyes, significantly reduced fatigue and improved cognitive performance. You don't need an hour in a flotation tank. You need 5 minutes of intentional sensory quietude several times a day.
That's encouraging because it means this is accessible to almost everyone. You don't need a dedicated room. You don't need special equipment. You can just close your eyes at your desk for 2 minutes. You can step into the bathroom and run cold water over your wrists. You can put on noise-canceling headphones without playing anything. These are tiny interventions that can shift your sensory state enough to keep you functional.
They're cumulative. Each micro break doesn't seem like much in isolation, but across a day, across a week, they add up to a significantly lower sensory load. It's like the difference between studying for an exam in one marathon session versus spreading it out over several days. The total time might be the same, but the cognitive cost is much lower when you distribute the load.
I want to go back to something Daniel said about podcasts specifically. He said he listens to our podcast, but also that sometimes he just sits in silence. And I think the podcast as a sensory tool is underappreciated. It's an interesting middle ground between silence and the chaos of ambient noise. It's controlled, it's predictable, it's familiar voices. Your brain can latch onto it and use it as a kind of anchor while everything else fades into the background.
That's actually a really good description of how auditory attention works. When you focus on a single auditory stream, like a conversation or a podcast, your brain suppresses competing streams through a process called selective auditory attention. It's not that you stop hearing the other sounds, it's that they're deprioritized. And familiar voices are particularly effective for this because your brain has already built predictive models for them. It knows the rhythm, the intonation, the vocabulary. It's less processing effort to follow a familiar voice than an unfamiliar one.
When Daniel puts on our podcast and lies on the cool floor, he's essentially doing a DIY version of what a sensory integration therapist would prescribe. Controlled auditory input, thermal grounding, reduced visual stimulation. He's assembled a sensory diet from things he already has.
That's the beauty of understanding the principles rather than just following a protocol. Once you understand that the goal is to modulate sensory input across channels, you can improvise. You can use whatever you have. A bag of frozen peas wrapped in a towel makes a perfectly good cold pack for grounding. A hoodie pulled over your eyes is a serviceable eye mask. A box fan is a white noise generator. The tools don't have to be fancy. The intentionality is what matters.
I think there's also something here about the social dimension of sensory overwhelm. Daniel's experience is happening in a family context. He's not alone. There's Hannah, there's Ezra, and I imagine there are times when stepping away to the quiet room feels like you're abandoning your partner to handle things alone.
That's a real tension, and it's one that couples need to negotiate explicitly. The solution isn't to never take breaks. The solution is to coordinate breaks so both partners get what they need. That might mean saying, hey, I'm hitting my sensory limit, can I take 15 minutes? And then I'll take over so you can do the same. It requires communication and mutual recognition that sensory needs are legitimate needs, not indulgences.
That communication is easier if you have a shared vocabulary for it. If you can say, my sensory glass is full right now, and your partner knows what that means and doesn't interpret it as you being dramatic or lazy, that's a much better dynamic than just snapping at each other because you're both overwhelmed and don't know how to articulate it.
This is one of the things I love about the sensory gating framework. It externalizes the problem. It's not that you're a bad parent or a bad partner. It's that your nervous system has a limited capacity for processing sensory input, and that capacity has been exceeded. That's a neutral statement of fact. It's not an accusation, and it's not a moral failing. And once you can talk about it in those terms, it becomes much easier to problem solve together.
Let's talk about some of the things Daniel didn't mention that might also be useful. He talked about sound, light, temperature, and the tactile experience of the floor. What about smell?
Olfactory input is powerful because the olfactory system has a direct line to the limbic system, the emotional center of the brain. It's the only sense that doesn't go through the thalamus first. So smells can trigger emotional responses faster and more intensely than other sensory inputs. Pleasant smells can be calming. Lavender has some evidence for reducing anxiety, though the effect size is modest. But the most important thing is probably just eliminating irritating smells. If your sensory refuge has a musty odor or smells like cleaning products, that's working against you.
What about movement? Daniel's lying still on the floor, but for some people, the best way to regulate sensory input is to move.
That's where the proprioceptive and vestibular systems come in. Proprioception is the sense of where your body is in space, engaged by heavy work, lifting, pushing, pulling. Vestibular input comes from movement of the head, rocking, swinging, spinning. Some people regulate best through stillness. Others regulate through movement. A sensory diet should include whatever works for you. If lying still feels good, do that. If you need to pace or rock or do push-ups, do that. The principle is the same. You're giving your nervous system the input it needs to return to an optimal state.
I'm realizing that we've been talking about sensory reduction as a response to overload. But there's also a preventative dimension. If you know you're going into a high sensory load situation, can you prepare in advance?
That's called sensory preloading, and it's a strategy occupational therapists use with kids who have sensory processing challenges, but it works for adults too. The idea is that you give your nervous system a dose of calming input before you enter the challenging environment. So before a loud family gathering, you might spend 20 minutes in a quiet, dim room with a weighted blanket. Before a day at a busy conference, you might start the morning with a long shower and minimal stimulation. You're essentially building up a sensory reserve that you can draw on when the load increases.
That's the glass half full versus half empty. If you start the day with your glass already half full, you've got less capacity for additional input. If you can start the day with your glass mostly empty, you've got more room.
That's why sleep quality matters so much for sensory processing. Poor sleep means you start the day with your sensory glass already partially full. Your nervous system hasn't had the chance to fully reset. There's a bidirectional relationship between sensory sensitivity and sleep. Sensory sensitivity can make it harder to sleep, and poor sleep makes you more sensory sensitive. Breaking that cycle often requires addressing both sides simultaneously. Better sleep hygiene plus sensory management during the day.
We should probably talk about when the home approach isn't enough. Daniel framed this as an alternative to clinical sensory deprivation tanks, and for most people, the home approach is probably sufficient. But there are people for whom sensory processing challenges are disabling, and they need more than blackout curtains and a weighted blanket.
Sensory processing disorder is a real clinical condition. It's not in the DSM, which is a whole separate conversation about diagnostic politics, but it's recognized by occupational therapists and it's treated with sensory integration therapy. For someone with severe SPD, the home strategies we're talking about are still useful, but they're complementary to professional treatment, not a replacement for it. If sensory issues are significantly impairing your ability to work, maintain relationships, or take care of yourself, that's the threshold where you should be talking to an occupational therapist, not just buying earplugs.
I think that's an important caveat, because the wellness industry has a way of taking clinical concepts and repackaging them as lifestyle advice, and in the process both trivializing the serious end of the spectrum and making people at the milder end feel like they need expensive interventions they don't actually need.
The commercialization of sensory health is a real problem. Flotation tanks are just one example. You've also got sensory deprivation chambers that cost thousands of dollars for home installation. You've got weighted blanket brands marketing themselves as medical devices with markups to match. You've got apps that promise to retrain your sensory processing with neural feedback with very limited evidence. The core insights are simple and accessible. The expensive versions are mostly just packaging.
Speaking of simple and accessible, I want to highlight one thing Daniel mentioned that I think is underrated. He said he lies flat on the ground, not on the couch, not on a bed, on the ground. And I think there's something about floor time that's different from lying on a soft surface.
Floor time is a real thing in sensory integration. It provides proprioceptive feedback through the entire back surface of the body. You're in contact with a firm, stable surface, and that sends a signal of stability to the nervous system. It's grounding in the literal sense. Beds and couches are soft and yielding, which is comfortable but doesn't provide the same proprioceptive input. There's a reason yoga ends with savasana, lying flat on the floor. It's not just about relaxation. It's about giving the nervous system a clear, unambiguous signal of physical stability.
Daniel specifically mentioned the kitchen floor, which is probably tile, which is cool. So he's combining the thermal grounding with the proprioceptive grounding. He's essentially hacking his nervous system with architecture.
He's doing exactly what a good occupational therapist would recommend, whether he knows it or not. The cool, hard surface is providing multiple channels of calming input simultaneously, and it's free. The kitchen floor is already there.
I think we should talk about the name Daniel couldn't remember. He said, too hot, too cold, and then stopped himself. The book is Too Loud, Too Bright, Too Fast, Too Tight by Sharon Heller, and I want to give it its due, because it was ahead of its time.
It really was. Heller wrote that book for a general audience at a time when sensory processing was almost exclusively discussed in clinical settings. She took the concept of sensory defensiveness and made it accessible. She described what it feels like to be overwhelmed by everyday sensations, and she offered practical strategies for managing it. The book came out in 2002, and it's still one of the best introductions to the topic for someone who's just starting to understand their own sensory sensitivity.
It's the kind of thing Daniel was talking about with AI surfacing buried information. That book existed. It was on shelves. But if you didn't know the term sensory defensiveness, you'd never find it. AI can bridge that gap. You can describe your experience in plain language. I feel like I'm crawling out of my skin when the lights are too bright. And the language model can say, oh, that sounds like sensory defensiveness. Here's a book about it.
That's the promise, and when it works, it's transformative. But as you pointed out earlier, it can also surface nonsense. So the skill becomes knowing how to evaluate what the AI gives you. Is this source credible? Is this claim testable? Does this align with what we know about neuroscience? That critical thinking layer is still essential.
All right, let's try to pull this together into something actionable. If someone's listening and thinking, I want to build my own sensory reduction setup, what's the shopping list?
Start with the basics. Blackout curtains or a good sleep mask for visual reduction. Earplugs or noise. Canceling headphones for auditory reduction. A fan or white noise machine if complete silence feels eerie. Some way to control temperature, even if it's just a small fan or an open window. And a firm surface to lie on, the floor works fine. That's the core kit. Everything beyond that is optimization. Weighted blanket if deep pressure feels good. Aromatherapy if certain smells calm you. A rocking chair if you need vestibular input. But start simple and add only what you actually need.
The most important component, which costs nothing, is permission to use it.
That's the one thing you can't buy on Amazon. The belief that your sensory needs are legitimate, that taking a break is not a failure, and that managing your nervous system is a responsible thing to do, not a selfish one.
I think that's a good place to land. Daniel started this conversation with a critique of sensory deprivation tanks, and ended up describing a much more practical, accessible, and honestly more humane approach. It's not about escaping the sensory world entirely. It's about turning down the volume when you need to, using tools you already have or can get cheaply, and giving yourself permission to do it without guilt.
The science supports it. Sensory modulation is not a luxury. It's a basic physiological need, especially for people with sensitive nervous systems, and especially in environments that are louder, brighter, and more chaotic than anything our ancestors had to deal with. The modern world is a sensory assault for a lot of people. Having a refuge isn't weakness, it's adaptation.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The national animal of Scotland is the unicorn. It has been since the 1200s, when it was adopted as a symbol of purity and power in Scottish heraldry. Scotland is one of the few countries whose national animal does not actually exist.
That explains a lot about Scotland, honestly.
I have no follow-up to that.
Here's the forward-looking thought. As AI continues to surface buried research, and as more people start to understand their own sensory profiles, I think we're going to see a shift.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.